content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Hello, this is Jen Rogers for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Smithsonian. Smithsonian is generously supported by the Kepin family. For the next half hour, I'll be reading to you from Smithsonian, the magazine of the Smithsonian Institute. On today's program, we'll start with an article titled "The Tea House at the Top of the World" by Aaron Tribe. A month-long trek into the Himalayas brings into focus the essential role of the region's modest mountainside lodges. We were only 3 days into a 27-day journey through the forest of eastern Nepal, pushing through low clouds and a steady downpour. Are we going the right way? I asked Arjun Raj, my guide on the Mira Peak trekking trail. I think so, he said, rain dripping from the bill of his baseball cap. I'm pretty sure. The mist was so dense we could barely see 100 feet ahead. It was an especially wet September, the end of monsoon season. As we descended a narrow, muddy gulch, we reached a rushing waterfall that cascaded down a rocky incline and directly blocked our path. To cross it, we slipped off our shoes and socks and waded barefoot through the icy torrent, which dropped off sharply to our right. Rai crossed with ease and grace, lightly gliding from one slick river stone to the next. I clumsily grabbed onto rocks in the water to hold my balance, trying not to scrape my feet or tumble down the waterfall to my death. After we made our way to the other side, Rai lit a cigarette and said, "Now, this is a real adventure." We looked at each other through the downpour and both threw our heads back in laughter, briefly forgetting that we were drenched, cold, and covered with mud. The positive outlook is the way of the Nepalis, and especially the native Nepalis of the mountains. When things get hard, which in the Himalayas is most of the time, you make the best of it and keep walking. Still, only about 7% of Nepal's population lives in these high-altitude regions. Life in the Solu Khumbu district, home to many of the country's tallest peaks, including Everest, is harsh and often unforgiving. Freezing temperatures, steep cliffs, infertile soil, and few drivable roads. Yet, its remoteness and rugged beauty are exactly what draws tourists here. Between October 2023 and September 2024, around 56,000 tourists visited Solu Khumbu, most of them foreigners. After 5 hours of trudging through the rain, we finally saw it, a small hut on the hillside, smoke curling from its entrance, a tea house. Reaching the doorway, I ducked beneath a low beam and found Pemba Doma Sherpa, 14, and her sister, Ming Makanichi, 7, tending the fire. Pemba Doma smiled shyly as she stirred a pot of po cha, or Sherpa tea. In this region, the thick, salty brew is made of zomo, a yak and cow hybrid butter, black tea, and roasted barley flour. As the rain drummed against the tin roof, she worked the churn, stirring the tea with a wooden dowel, her movements steady and practiced. This modest tea house is one of the hundreds of simple mountain shelters that are the lifeblood of Himalayan trekking, serving as rest stops and social hubs for climbers, herders, and travelers moving between the villages. Tourists stop here for many reasons: to rest, stay overnight, eat, and dry their clothes by the fire. But often what they're seeking is connection. Conversations around tea house stoves can stretch for hours, spanning languages and continents. Inside, the food is hearty and nourishing. Steaming plates of dal bhat, Nepal's national dish of lentil stew with rice, vegetables, and pickles, momos, soft dumplings filled with meat or vegetables and served with spicy dipping sauce, roti, a thin unleavened flatbread, and thukpa, a thick noodle soup. These meals reflect a blend of Indian, Tibetan, and Chinese influences, humble but built for endurance and warmth. Some tea houses are operated by wives of mountain guides who spend months away leading expeditions. Many others are family run, some passed down through the generations. For many women, and families, the tea house is more than a business. It's a vital source of stability. It keeps families, many named for the Sherpa ethnic group, rooted in their ancestral villages, financially provides for their children's education, and creates a steady income in places where few other opportunities exist. The tea house in the next village, Romailo Danda, belongs to Puratempa Sherpa, a retired mountain guide. My father built this place himself, his son and lodge manager, Chongba Sherpa, told me. It was a jungle before. He cut the hillside by hand to make flat ground. At first it was very small, only enough space for 6 people. Every year he added a little more, stone by stone. Puratempa started guiding when he was around 20. He tried to summit Everest 5 times and made it twice. When he retired, he turned his focus to the tea house, work that was no easier. The hardest thing, Puratempa said, was water. There's no natural source here. We tried pipes from 3,000 meters away, about 2 miles up the valley, but it didn't work. Finally, we brought water from 450 meters, about 1,500 feet below, pumping it through the rock. He paused, then smiled. Now it works, mostly. Puratempa also owns another tea house farther up the trail in Chatrakola, the Mira Riverside Lodge, perched on the edge of a bluff beside a roaring river and a waterfall that feeds the valley below. There, a young woman named Rachana Rai worked in the kitchen, stirring pots of lentils and kneading dough. I like it here, she told me. It's quiet, but not lonely. The mountains keep me company. Every major trek in Solo Kumbu begins with a flight into Lukla, a small town perched on a cliff with a runway so short and steep it's considered one of the most dangerous in the world. From there, trails wind northeast toward Everest Base Camp, some 64 miles away on foot, or east for 40 miles toward Mira Peak, 21,247 feet. At Mira's high camp, approximately 19,000 feet, stands what is said to be the highest tea house in Nepal. Surrounded by ice falls, cornices, and jagged seracs, it's run by Sherpa cooks who live there for weeks at a time in sub-freezing cold. We don't make much, maybe 30,000 rupees, about $210 a month, one told me through an interpreter. They rely on tips. Tourists are kind. Even with little salary, we are happy to work. When they smile and say thank you, we feel rich. The Sherpa people, whose name comes from the Tibetan words shar, east, and pa, people, are celebrated for their endurance and grace at altitude. Descended from nomads who migrated south from Tibet, they settled in the Solon Kumbu region centuries ago and became the backbone of Himalayan mountaineering. While climbers from around the world seek glory on these peaks, it's the Sherpas who guide climbers, fix the ropes, break trails, carry the loads, and when necessary, recover the fallen. As they did during my own time on Mira, when a Korean climber died and a Sherpa rescue team found his body and brought him down the mountain. Sherpa culture is steeped in Buddhism. Along the trails, the landscape is marked by mani stones, carved with prayers, mantras, or religious images, and stupas, dome-shaped Buddhist shrines. Strings of blue, white, red, green, and yellow prayer flags flutter in the wind. Inside the tea houses, the rhythm of life slows. Fires crackle, tea simmers, and stories are told easily between strangers. For the tea house staff, the work is relentless. Cooking, cleaning, stoking fires in thin air. But most owners I spoke of pride, not exhaustion. People come from everywhere, says Lakpa Sherpa, owner of Himalayan Lodge and Cafe in Kote. We take care of them like family. That is our way. On the final morning of the ascent, we left high camp at 3 a.m., climbing slowly toward Mira's summit as dawn broke, casting an alpine glow on pristine slopes. Our pace was steady. As I continued my way upward, the sun appeared over the mountaintops, and the full expanse of the Himalayas came into view. Everest to the north, Makalu to the northeast, a sweep of glistening peaks stretching in all directions, and the villages we'd passed through scattered far below. By day 21 of the journey, I visited nearly a dozen tea houses, had hundreds of conversations, and sipped countless cups of Sherpa tea. Now, as we headed back to Lukla, it struck me how much this climb had depended on the families who opened their doors along the way and offered warmth and a place to find by cold. In Nepal, the rugged landscape is shaped by mountains, but it's the Nepali people in the tea houses that make moving through it possible. Next, we'll move on to an article by John Semley titled Greatest Movie Ever. With his 1954 triumph, Akira Kurosawa became one of the most influential directors of all time. The film was long and getting longer by the day. Worse still, the director was bent on shooting outdoors on a mountainous peninsula west of Tokyo, and the rain, during the interminably long production period between 1953 and 1954, was just as bent on falling in heavy sheets. Before production was anywhere close to wrapped, the budget was already 10 times that of the average Japanese film, and the ballooning expenses led to extended hiatuses and shooting as the Toho Motion Picture Company scrambled to find more money. In the national press, meanwhile, the production was already a byword for bloat and dysfunction. The director had earned the disparaging nickname Kurosawa Tenno, or Emperor Kurosawa, a nod to his authoritarian bearing and the way his most ambitious film was expanding into its own miniature shogunate. Seemingly untroubled by these costly, unproductive, and highly publicized delays, the acclaimed Japanese director Akira Kurosawa would use the free time to go fishing. On one such trip, actor and frequent collaborator Minoru Chiaki asked the notoriously stubborn director if he was worried about the project completely running aground. "So long as my pictures are hits," the director responded, while dangling his line off the banks of the Tama River, "I can afford to be unreasonable." Kurosawa once famously compared Japanese cinema to green tea over rice, light and wholesome. With this new film, Seven Samurai, an extraordinary action epic, he was seeking to make heartier fare, a film he hoped would be entertaining enough to eat. Kurosawa's intransigence was rewarded. The 207-minute Seven Samurai, with its extended scenes of swordplay and grandly conceived action sequences, was as innovative as it was epic, drawing superlatives from critics, turning a generation onto Japanese cinema, and changing popular culture forever. Its story, characters, multi-camera shooting, and action choreography reoriented American movie-making for generations. Even those who haven't seen the movie itself have likely seen a version of it, whether in a straight remake like The Magnificent Seven, 1960, or in countless homages from the Steve Martin comedy Three Amigos to Pixar's A Bug's Life. Today, 71 years after its release, Seven Samurai still resonates. Each character seems unique, sketched in loving detail, while the filmmaker itself remains bracingly vivid. Eschewing the stiffer, sturdier theatrics of Japanese epics of the era, Kurosawa cut his action scenes using multiple cameras, giving them a heightened sense of vim and realism. Despite its faraway 16th century setting, Seven Samurai felt and still feels disquietingly modern. In the end, despite the rain and bad press, Kurosawa's masterpiece elevated not only the Japanese sword fight movie, but also many of the American westerns that inspired it, proving that great subtlety and artistry could be found in the domain of genres often dismissed as frivolous or merely entertaining. Movies would never be the same. Born in Tokyo in 1910, Kurosawa was descended from actual samurai. The family traced its lineage back to warriors who had served an 11th century warlord. His father, a former soldier, was proud of this bloodline. He was a stern disciplinarian, always instructing his family in what the filmmaker has called the finer points of samurai etiquette. But Kurosawa the Elder did permit certain lighter entertainment, especially Western cinema. As a child, Akira studied traditional Japanese arts like calligraphy, as well as kendo, Japanese bamboo swordplay, at which he excelled despite his admitted lack of strength. But he also spent hours in movie theaters, taking in Japanese productions and Western imports. His older brother Haigo worked as a benshi, a narrator providing live commentary and context for Western silent movies screened for Japanese audiences. His brother's work afforded the young Kurosawa not only exposure to great many foreign films, but also something just as important, free movie tickets. As a student in the 1920s, Kurosawa initially devoted himself to art at Kyoto's Doshisha School of Western Painting. He soon realized his talents in that field would barely rise above illustrations for magazines on the cheap. "I would knock myself out doing this," Kurosawa had said, "but you can't make a living this way." Film, on the other hand, would pay. At the same time, his well-rounded student life was introducing him to all manner of thought and literature from Europe, particularly the plays of Shakespeare, the novels of Fyodor Dostoevsky, and the economic and historical theory of Karl Marx. All this time burying himself in Western movies, literature and art informed Kurosawa's approach as a young filmmaker. Starting in the mid-1930s, he worked his way up from an assistant director at Toho, one of Japan's preeminent studios, then called PCL Cinema Studio. In subsequent years, his work would proudly exhibit this broad range of influences, including several Shakespeare adaptations and a film based on The Idiot by Dostoevsky, the author who, Kurosawa thought, writes most honestly about human existence. Kurosawa translated his early Japanese success into international interest with films like Drunken Angel, 1948, and Stray Dog in 1949. And by 1952, his Rashomon was voted the finest foreign film at the 24th Academy Awards. Kurosawa initially conceived Seven Samurai as a slick, inventive retooling of the stuffier tradition of Japanese sword fight pictures called Chanbara, which many Japanese critics compared to American westerns, simple stories filled with stock characters. But Kurosawa had more respect for Hollywood traditions than many of these critics did. He believed that, just as directors like John Ford had found a way to dignify and exalt the aesthetic and emotional landscapes of the studio western, he too could make a sword fight movie that was historically detailed and immensely entertaining. The plot of Seven Samurai will almost certainly be familiar. In the countryside of 16th century Japan, a group of villagers gets wind that a troop of bandits is preparing to attack right when the village's barley harvest is due. With little military experience and practically no weapons at their disposal, these farmers enlist a group of warriors to come to their defense. We see the villagers recruit successive samurai, each with a distinct type. There's the wise and veteran, Kanbei, Takashi Shimura, the severe master swordsman, Kiyozo, Seiji Miyaguchi, and the spirited sake-glugging lout, Kukuchio, Toshiro Mifune, half-puck and half-Falstaff, and not actually a real samurai at all. Once assembled, the motley squad trains the villagers in the basics of warfare, and the bandits arrive, and the samurais lead the plucky farmers through an extended, breathlessly exciting defense of their village and their bountiful stores of barley. It's a simple story, hence in part the near-infinite possibilities for retelling it. Film critic Sean Gilman considers Seven Samurai the universal model of a men-on-a-mission movie, and the film was formative for a revolutionary generation of American directors. George Lucas has recalled being dragged to a screening of Seven Samurai by his film school friend and fellow director, John Milius. "After that, I was completely hooked." Steven Spielberg has called Kurosawa a true visionary, Martin Scorsese invoking the samurai traditions of apprenticeship and ascendancy, once called Kurosawa his master. Each new generation of filmmakers tries to elevate their genres they grew up on, make them artier, more sophisticated, more politically committed, Gilman says. The new Hollywood filmmakers saw that in Kurosawa. He made samurai films, but he made elevated samurai films, in the same way they wanted to elevate westerns and gangster films. For these American young guns, Kurosawa exemplified new ways of investing noir pictures, sci-fi stories, and shark thrillers with a renewed sense of verse and seriousness. Though Kurosawa's career spanned 50 years and some 30 films, many of them masterpieces, Seven Samurai remains his most influential and most beloved. In 2022, the taste-making, canon-forming once-a-decade poll conducted by the influential British film magazine Sight and Sound counted Seven Samurai among the 20 gravest movies of all time. Akira Kurosawa died of a stroke in 1998 at the age of 88. His body was interred in a modest grave in a cemetery behind a small Buddhist temple overlooking the surfing beaches of Kamakura, a seaside town south of Tokyo, known best for its many Zen shrines. It's a particularly humble resting place that feels oddly fitting. In a bitter irony, Kurosawa's overwhelming popularity in the West partly soured his reputation in his native Japan. Even Seven Samurai came in for a drubbing from some domestic critics. One writer griped that Kurosawa pitting Japanese characters against each other risked compromising political and social harmony in the brittle post-war period. In Japan, Kurosawa's films were often regarded as macho, immature, and even, in Roger Ebert's account, too Western. For Kurosawa, such divisions never really made sense. "The Western and the Japanese live side by side in my mind," he once remarked, "without the least bit of conflict." Now a little Postscript article by Sonia Anderson titled "Flipping the Script." Akira Kurosawa's 1950 film Rashomon depicts events from four competing perspectives, a revolutionary narrative device many television shows have mimicked. Like All in the Family and Everybody Tells the Truth, 1973, members of the Bunker family recount the day repairmen come to fix the fridge. Mike's recollection shows his angry father-in-law, Archie, antagonizing the technicians. But Archie recalls everyone mistreating him, including a white repairman dressed like a mobster and a rude black repairman in hippie garb. The Odd Couple, from 1972, in an episode titled A Night to Dismember, finds Oscar roped into a dinner date with his ex-wife, Blanche, on the anniversary of their divorce. Each tells the story of their final fight, which occurred during a New Year's Eve party. In Blanche's flashback, she finds her husband smooching a female guest in the bedroom. Oscar shows him chivalrously putting that inebriated guest to bed. And the vivid memory of their friend Felix, who crashes the date, focuses on his conciliatory efforts and prowess as a ladies' man. You have The X-Files and Bad Blood, 1998. Detectives Scully and Mulder travel to Texas to investigate bodies drained of blood. Their boss needs a report, so each detective lays out their version of the trip. Scully recalls shooting at a human intruder in their room at the Davy Crockett Motor Court and missing. But Mulder recalls those bullets hitting their mark at the Sam Houston Motor Lodge and an unharmed vampire leaping away. Star Trek The Next Generation, in a matter of perspective from 1990, Manuel Apgar accuses Commander Will Riker of killing her husband and trying to assault her, so the crew of the USS Enterprise reconstructs the episode. Riker inputs his recollections into the ship's computer, as do Apgar and her husband's assistant. Their memories play as a holographic movies before a tribunal. Riker insists Apgar is lying, but then Enterprise's counselor disagrees, saying it is the truth as each of you remembers it. And finally, The Dick Van Dyke Show. At the start of The Night the Roof Fell In, 1962, spouses Rob and Laura have a fight when he comes home late from work. As Laura recalls the spat to a confidant, the audience sees her all dressed up, patiently serving dinner to an abrasive, unkempt, neglectful Rob. But when Rob recalls the argument at work, the flashback shows him dancing through the door like Fred Astaire, only to endure a grumpy Laura who hasn't bothered to cook or to wash the 3-foot-tall stack of dirty dishes. And finally, we'll move to an article titled First in Glass by Angelica Hankins. A visionary Venetian entrepreneur revived the centuries-old art on the island of Murano. In cities from London to Istanbul, monarchs spent the 16th and 17th centuries delighting in the hand-blown glass emerging from the island of Murano and Venice. There, artisans had elevated glassmaking to an exquisite height, each vase and stem delicately conceived and rendered. By the 19th century, the tradition had nearly fallen away. The Venetian Republic dissolved in 1797, and now the world-famous artistry of Venetian glass was in danger of being lost. Antonio Salviati was determined to revive it. Born in 1816 in Vicenza, Italy, just 39 miles west of Venice, Salviati became a hard-driving lawyer and then businessman. Growing frustrated by the decaying mosaics in St. Mark's Basilica, a global landmark and one of the city's crowning jewels, he saw an opportunity. In 1859, he started his own glass factory on the island of Murano to produce enamel tiles and later blown glass. He impressed the administrators at St. Mark's, who granted him a 15-year contract to supply, repair, and design new mosaics for the beloved church. Especially deft in spotting talent, Salviati hired the best craftsmen he could afford and encouraged them to draw from the Renaissance masters and marvels of old and the resplendent designs that they created by hand. The reproductions were startlingly accurate. As early as 1866, the art journal noted that Salviati's pieces were selling as veritable antiques. The glass was breathtakingly designed. Handmade vases of ultramarines and iridescent crimsons, glass spouts veined into silvery sea foams, onyx jars scalloped with bands of gold. Salviati had the soul of an artist, and the wonders that filled his eyes in Venice each day took possession of his thoughts. The Italian zoologist and translator Michele Lissona wrote in an 1884 retrospective, "He witnessed the decadence of the arts of glassmaking and mosaic and was filled with the noble desire to bring them back to life." As word of his marvelous factory spread, Salviati found backing from British investors and founded another company in London in 1866, which quickly became something of a sensation. The architect and designer, Charles Eastlake, marveled at the pieces in Salviati's London shop, which he wrote in 1868, have not indeed the cold accuracy of form and spotless sheen of an ordinary dessert service, but they are far more picturesque in appearance. Soon Salviati was everywhere. His factory designed mosaics for the South Kensington Museum, now the Victoria and Albert, and his glasses sold at Tiffany & Company on New York's Fifth Avenue. And Marcel Proust's In Search of Lost Time, the social climber Madame de Villeparisis asked her former lover, Monsieur de Norpois, if he's been to Salviati's. For Proust, as for many others, the glassmaker had become an undeniable mark of style in an impressionable world. To own a Salviati was to arrive in society. The art journal pronounced in 1870 that any table without Venetian glass was incomplete. Salviati's rise coincided with a new way of seeing art. In mid-19th century Britain, as the Industrial Revolution gained steam, the writer John Ruskin and others railed against mass production. They argued vehemently for a return to the dexterity and grace of the workman's hand. Ruskin lauded traditional Venetian artists and who invented a new design for every glass. Salviati, then, was his carefully constructed masterworks was well received, especially in Britain. All his life, Salviati instilled in his glassmakers a devotion to traditional artistry, to the fanciful, to work that dazzles. Salviati's aim, says Reno Lefkis, curator of glass at the Victoria and Albert Museum, was to manifest the good taste particular to Italy. When Salviati died in 1890, his factory continued in that spirit, as do dozens of other factories on Murano. Some are family businesses that existed for centuries before Salviati, but it's possible they might not be here without him. There was a legend in the 16th century that Venetian glassware was so fragile it could not survive any contact with poison. A single drop, it was said, could shatter it beyond repair. It's that gossamer-thin delicacy that continues to lend Venetian glass its limpid brilliance and otherworldly allure. As the art critic James Jackson Jarvis wrote in Harper's Monthly in 1881, the city's glass appealed to the human craving for beauty, perfection, the supreme aesthetic ideal, with a beauty rooted in the infinite. We've run out of time for today's episode of Smithsonian, generously underwritten by the Kepin family. We hope you've enjoyed listening. Please join us next time. I'm Jen Rogers, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Smithsonian is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.